Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Sandra Fahey, Associate Professor in Anthropology at Sophia University in Tokyo, about her book, Marching Through Suffering, Loss and Survival in North Korea, which was published in 2015 by Columbia University Press, who are also bringing out a new paperback edition early in 2019. A lot has been in flux on the Korean Peninsula over the past year, even if attempting to forecast where things will go from here remains as unwise as ever. But one issue which seems unlikely to go away is the question of human rights and concern over the well-being of North Korea's population, a subject which arguably came most forcefully to the world's attention during the catastrophic famine which affected the country from the mid to late 1990s. This tragedy forms the background to Sandra Fahey's Marching Through Suffering, which draws on many interviews with famine survivors who later escaped the country to South Korea and Japan. Guided throughout by Fahey's careful observation, analysis, and framing, we enter the subjective life worlds of a wide range of North Koreans, parents and children, bureaucrats and farmers, soldiers, miners, and students, getting a full sense not so much of the lacks or absences often stressed in discussion of famine, but of how these people confronted and coped with the crisis, what took place in the lacuna, as Fahey herself puts it. Proceeding through accounts of people's realization of the reality of what was happening and of the consequences of the disaster for community, political, and economic life, Fahey treats this devastating and difficult subject with immense care and nuance, making close attention to the language used by her interlocutors a central pillar of the book. With directness and clarity, Marching Through Suffering gives voice to speakers whose experiences must surely remain in all of our minds as we try better to understand a North Korean society which recent developments have once again brought to global attention. But in any case, on the subject of attention, I'll thank you listeners for listening and say, Sandra Fahey, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Ed. It's my pleasure to be here.
No, well, it's great to have you on. It's a fantastic book, and it's great news that it'll be renewed in paperback format early next year. But perhaps I could begin by asking you something about your academic background, where you were trained, and how you became interested in the subject of this book.
Okay, well, to start, I did my bachelor's degree and my Master of Arts in Canada at York University. And at that time, my first degree was in English literature. And I had always been interested, I mean, since my high school days, in survivor literature, fiction and nonfiction written by people who'd survived different types of collective social suffering. So it seemed quite natural to me that my first degree would be in literature. And then for my master's degree, I studied interdisciplinary studies, which was history, anthropology, and also literature again. The primary, I guess, intellectual question that started in my mind prior to my master's degree was, do different types of collective social suffering produce different types of kind of survivor narrative, because I had read so many survivor narratives from, for instance, the Holocaust or different sorts of genocide. I was just really curious about other types of collective social suffering. And one that was forefront of my mind was famine. And so for my master's degree, I studied the famine, the Irish famine of 1847, and was looking at, you know, the historical record of that and trying to find survivor narratives. So for me, like, the questions were immediately about language, of course, colonization, having a foreign power in the land, and how food shortage affected people, how it affected their relationships, things like this. So that was in my early 20s, and I really wanted for my PhD work to find, go to a place where there were famine survivors and collect their oral history, because what I saw when I looked at the global historical record is that there were no collections, there were no survivor narratives. I mean, it was all, if it was written, it was written by journalists, it was written by outsiders. You know, so I was really curious, like, if such individuals were to write their stories, if they were to speak about it, what would they say? So that was a primary intellectual question that drove me. And then very pragmatically, you know, I mean, I was in my early 20s. I thought, oh, well, where can I go in the world where there could be people who have survived famine? Of course, I knew about the famine in Ethiopia, but that had happened in the mid 80s. And, but of course, this was in the early 2000s that all of this was going on in my mind, late 1990s, early 2000s. And I knew about what was happening in North Korea. And I thought, oh, okay, I will go to South Korea and I will learn Korean and I will meet North Koreans, because I knew, of course, that they were coming out to South Korea. And many of my friends, well, I suppose I should say acquaintances, they were like, oh my gosh, I'll never be able to do that. Like, you should have been studying this language from the age of five or whatever in order to get any kind of competency. But I'm a very determined person when I want to do something. So then I set off before my PhD to go to South Korea. And I knew with a master's degree, I would be fortunate enough to get an English teaching job in South Korea. And I'm very grateful to South Korea that I was able to go there and have a reasonably good job, that I was able to do language study at the same time as my job, and that I was able to then work with the North Korean defectors in South Korea. And that was prior to any of my PhD work. And then anyway, I could go on, but then I did my PhD work and I did the actual field research for the book. So, but that was the primary question that drove it. You know, what would survivor narratives of famine, which is a form of political violence, I mean, some people might not use the word violence because of the way it manifests. Famine manifests quite differently from something like the Holocaust, obviously, or different types of genocide, but we can get into that later. Mm. But that was the primary question that it was born in.
So that's pretty interesting. I guess many people come to North Korean studies in as much as that is a kind of substantial disciplinary corner for North Korea, you know, I think because of particular interest in the specificities of North Korea. And I think you represent a very interesting alternative perspective on the country, coming to the place from an issue perspective with a question in mind that, as you say, has wider applicability. I just wonder, is there something particular about the human condition, about humanity that sustained your interest there in survival literature? What sort of things did you find revealed in general, not just in the North Korean case, but in your preceding studies about humans from this genre of survival literature?
I think when I started reading literature from survivors of collective social suffering, I felt this, I don't know, I mean, I don't wish to sound grandiose, but I felt this sort of sense of duty or responsibility, like if there were things going on during my lifetime that I wanted to somehow play a part in trying to ameliorate that suffering in some small way. Like, I just often felt like, my gosh, like a kind of sense of duty to my fellow humans. I don't know, like a kind of, but I suppose also maybe just a curiosity or a sense of, just a sense that if I, I guess I felt that if I had been on the inside of such an experience, I would want to know that there was somebody outside of that experience working on my behalf without trying to sound too grandiose. That was just always my feeling. And so I would, having somebody who was born free and living her whole life with immense privilege, felt that I wanted to have a duty to my fellow human in that way.
Yeah, I think that's I think something that should be able to be said without fear of cynicism or accusations of being grandiose, as you say. So that's very interesting. And when it comes to the book and the transition from the PhD, which, as you say, did supplementary work with the defectors and the survivors for, how did the process of PhD into book occur?
Well, I did I applied for my PhD, I guess it was 2003. I started my PhD 2004. I applied to schools back in Canada and in the United States. But then I also applied to schools in the UK, and I was accepted at SOAS. And I was quite happy about that because I got to work with Johan Potier. He's a professor of anthropology who worked on the Rwandan genocide and different famines throughout Africa, and Keith Howard, who is also an anthropologist, ethnomusicologist, who works on Korea. And so kind of with the thematic combination, regional combination of both of those professors, I felt I was really well guided. I then had done so many years of work with NGOs in South Korea with defectors, so I had that kind of grounding. I think in many ways I was a bit naive. Like, I hadn't thought of that moment. Like, we as anthropologists, when we go into the field, you know, it's that awkward thing about how do you say to someone, okay, now I want to talk about this thing with you, which is possibly the most horrible experience you've ever had in your life. And I don't know you that well. And so I hadn't thought about that moment. I don't know. And I think that's just the way we are prior to field work. I mean, field work is kind of like a baptism by fire. I feel like field work kind of really changes you as a scholar. Like, I felt, I'm sure perhaps for you it was the same. Like, I felt like I was moving from a child into an adult. So yeah, just that feeling of the field work was quite scary, even though, like, I had been in the community and I had no, I wasn't an alien to that environment. But the thing that surprised me, well, you know, I mean, I suppose it must have been the same for you. Like, I had anticipated certain outcomes. I had anticipated hearing certain answers. And when I didn't hear them, I was quite shocked. And it was, you know, I mean, I think field work should be an education to ourselves. Like, it's like when you write, a book, you learn as you write. It's not as if you know everything and you just are writing it down. I mean, that's what a PhD is too. Like, you are learning from the data. The data is teaching you. So, for instance, some of the things that really came as a surprise to me, like, I had naively thought, like, if you experience oppression, if you're subjugated, I had often thought, like, I had really thought that it sounds ridiculous to say, but that oppressed subjects bear a resemblance to each other, and that resemblance will manifest in how they resist or how they understand their oppression and how they resist it, which, I mean, maybe if I had read more, I would have known that was ridiculous, but that's just the way it was for me. I really thought, and I guess, look, to be honest, I suspect a lot of people think that way, that that oppressed subjects experience their oppression similarly and they respond to it similarly. So for instance, how does that, like, manifest on the ground? Like, I had thought that North Koreans would had experienced the famine and that they saw the government as culpable. So I was already moving from that point to ask the question of, well, how did you, you know, take out your frustration toward the government? But even prior to that, I should have been asking them, like, I realized, and they taught me. The question was really like, what was the experience like? How did you even, like, know, to whom did you direct your frustration? You know, and that's what I learned, that, like, really, the questions are, you actually have to step your questions way back, if that makes any sense.
Mm. No, that makes sense. Yeah, I guess perhaps we could move on to talk a little bit about some of the background in general before jumping into some of these responses, which obviously make up the body of the book itself. Would you mind, not that it's something particularly pleasant to talk about, but the famine as a situation, when it occurred and what it involved, would you be able to say a little bit about that, just to kind of refresh listeners' memories of what occurred in North Korea in the mid to late 90s?
Sure. Yeah, that's actually the basic place that we should start. So, you know, if you look at the kind of policy literature, the academic literature, it'll a lot of the time state that the famine started around the mid-1990s. But actually, you know, the famine in North Korea, the issue with access to food happened as early as the late 1980s in some parts of the country. So that's the first thing to know, like that the famine was not equally distributed throughout the country when it began. So in some places like Pyongyang, they would say the famine started around the mid-1990s. The worst years of the famine, meaning if we calculate like the sheer number of mortalities, was in 1997, 1998. But definitely at least 8-9 years before that, things were quite horrendous. Why did the famine happen in North Korea in the first place? I mean, it's really interesting to think about because at that time, I mean, yes, then in the late 1990s, there was IMF crisis, etc. But, you know, North Korea is sitting amidst quite strong economies. Why is it that North Koreans are dying for their inability to get access to food? Well, the primary reason that the famine happened in North Korea, I mean, yes, there were environmental problems. There was a lot of flooding. There were droughts. But in no part of the world, and this is the important thing for readers to come away with, I mean, scholars who work on famine in other parts of the world will know this, there's no reason for a famine to happen in any part of the world, particularly in the last half of the 20th century. I mean, you know, so the reason why that's the case is that, you know, we have early warning signals for famine. And we know if there's going to be environmental factors that are going to cause food shortage. And thus, we can bring in food from elsewhere. Prices can be altered. So there's no reason for food a famine to be happening in some place like Yemen, as it is as we speak, or in Venezuela. These things are, in fact, the result of politics. And so and many people would just say simply, it's about power. It's about power politics. It's about conflict. So in the case of North Korea, the North Korean government could have made decisions that would have altered its economy, that would have altered its politics to give its people access to food. They chose otherwise. They chose to prioritize the military. They chose to continue with the socialist economy, the socialist agriculture approach, which was very intensive farming, scientific methods. They didn't open up, at least not immediately, the markets, free markets to the people. They didn't allow people to migrate throughout the country to find food in other areas. They didn't allow people to sell. They didn't allow people to leave the country to find food elsewhere. So all of these factors coalesced to create a situation where people couldn't alter their access to food. That's what Amartya Sen talks about in his books, Development and Freedom, etc. People, when people cannot alter their access to food, and by which I mean they can't sell their furniture to in the market to get money to buy food. They can't migrate. They can't advocate for themselves. They can't make demands of their government. When that's the case, then you have famine, which is politically motivated. So that's what happened in North Korea. And the percentage of deaths, we don't even to this day know, but they argue it's between 220,000. Some people say upwards of 2 million people died. We still don't know the numbers. Even North Korea itself doesn't know the numbers.
Mm-hmm. And you lay all this out in pretty clear terms in an appendix to the book, which is very helpful. But then as we move into the introduction and you kind of set the scene here, there are a few key additional aspects to how the famine was experienced that you allude to, which remain key themes throughout the whole book. For one thing, whether it's referred to as a famine and what respondents, what your interlocutors' responses were to you using words for famine when discussing these issues. So perhaps could you say something about how the famine is spoken of and recalled by some of the people you spoke to, and actually, as you already mentioned, how you went about approaching this extremely difficult subject with people who had, as you say, survived pretty tragic and devastating events.
When I met North Koreans, I was working in the NGO community, the North Korean defector community, but I didn't really want to interview people who were politically active. So I asked those who I knew, if I could interview their family and friends, and they connected me. But always I told everybody, like, look, I want to talk to you about the food problem. I want to talk to you about the famine. And of course I use that term, Kia Kigun, but I also use the term Koneni Hengun, which is the March of Suffering, which is the term North Korea used. The North Korean state used that term. They used a few other terms too, but they primarily used that term. And the first thing I'll say about that is that, my anticipation that people would feel reluctant or even embarrassed to talk about, that extremely difficult time of their lives, what I found is that people were eager to talk to me about that time, that they really wanted to talk about that. And this came as a pleasant surprise to me, but a surprise nonetheless. The other thing that's really interesting is that, like I said, North Koreans immediately just came back to me and said, oh, you mean the Koneni Hengun, you mean the March of Suffering, the famine. Like, they often didn't even know the Korean word, which is originally Chinese for famine or starvation. They didn't know these terms. But I just want to say on that point, and then going, this goes to the broader literature on famine, which is that that's not uncommon. I mean, the Great Leap Forward famine in China was called the 3-year natural calamity. I suspect if we were to interview some people who are in Yemen right now, there'd be a particular term to refer to it, and the same in Venezuela for what's happening. So there are these very localized terms which are meant for erasure, that are meant to soften the type of experience that people are having. And there's something else to say about that, which is that, famine is something which is different from other types of political violence. It's a very indirect form of violence. It builds itself into society quite slowly. It's not an event. It's not an event like an earthquake or a tsunami or, it will slowly build itself into a society. So you can have a famine taking place in areas like Chongjin, northeast and North Korea, for many years before it reaches a place like Pyongyang. People in Pyongyang had no idea what was going on in places like Chongjin.
Mm-hmm. And well, actually, that provides a pretty convenient link into the first chapter of the book, after the introduction, that the busy years is the title. And really, a lot of what this chapter concerns is the idea of, or the process of realization, and how people came to terms with the idea that this thing was, as you put it there, sort of creeping into their lives. What kind of experiences allowed people to come to that realization, and how did they initially react, or what was their sort of interpretation of the food shortages that crept in?
Well, the thing that's interesting that I decided to start with for that first chapter was, I think that's where one of the young North Korean defectors is telling me that she associated famine with something happening in Africa, no country being specified. You know, it was really, and this is something we can appreciate as anthropologists, a very localized interpretation of events. People thought, oh, well, what's happening for us is, you know, it's just a kind of glitch. There was this delayed kind of a sense that that there will be reprieve, the delusion of reprieve, that at some point we will be saved from the situation that we're in. At some point, things are going to improve. So that was the, you know, because in North Korea, they distribute food through something called the public distribution system. And because of the famine, of course, which was because the government was making decisions which were not in the people's interest, the public distribution was malfunctioning. So when people would go to the distribution centers, there wasn't anything to collect. They would be told, "We'll come back next week," or come back next month," and the same answer would be received that next month or whatever. How I asked then, how did you know that the famine was happening? And of course, you know, as anthropologists, we like to kind of ask naive questions we maybe already have an idea of what the answer might be. So I said things like, "Oh, well, but did the government advertise? Did they, you know, publicized that there was a food shortage and, you know, this type of thing?" Of course, they said, no, not at all. I mean, how we came to know that the famine was happening is that suddenly, like, teachers weren't showing up at school anymore because they were too busy foraging in the mountains. Teachers were falling asleep at their desks. Well, suddenly I saw this in this person who ordinarily should have been in their job, but they were actually selling in the black market. We heard certain rumors. I mean, this is how information circulated. You put bits and pieces together. And then, of course, you know, it escalated. It got worse. I mean, why did they call it the busy years? Because people were kind of running all over the place trying to piece their lives together in such a way that they could get enough money to buy food on the black market to live. I mean, it was like the time of hustling, you know, the time of moonlighting, you know, doing two jobs at once, the one for the state and the one which really earns your income.
And you mentioned that how it kind of crept into, or how it arrived in contexts, as you mentioned, through, for example, teachers not showing up, and really sort of shifts occurring in both people's day-to-day activities, as you say, hustling and trying to make ends meet in new and unfamiliar ways, but also in the way that society was sort of existing in relation to itself, how different members of society, whether they were teachers or workers in certain fields, were affected differentially by the famine, and therefore that led to a sort of reconfiguration of how people were relating to each other. It's important as well that you outlay very beautifully how the famine dynamics map onto existing societies, existing social dynamics. So perhaps moving into the second chapter, which you entitle Cohesion and Disintegration, could you say something more about the effects of the famine there on societal dynamics as it became more and more acute, and whether people were more inclined to stick together, whether they were driven apart by the effects of the famine?
Yes, that, look, I mean, people talk all the time how in East Asia there's this sense of like a familiarity, like the, you know, the importance of family and the bond. And you know how in Korean they'll use the expression our wife, meaning my wife, but it's our, the sense of the collective, the we. And that's really strong in North Korea too. I mean, just as an anecdote, I'll say, like, you know, South Korea is a very warm, communal for me, my experience, at least of South Korea, is that like people are very, they will inject themselves into your business, whether you want it or not. And this is the same in North Korea, at least if the people that I know from North Korea are any accurate, you know, have any accurate assessment of things, you know, that there is this kind of sense of the collective, that we're in this together. So that's quite interesting when you have a situation which is very divisive and shortage of resources in a fixed market is something that's going to create divisiveness. It's going to create trouble. And it did that in North Korea. I mean, certain people were more closely bonded together, but in other ways, it created a lot of disintegration. There are even nowadays, of course, still reports of the military taking advantage, soldiers taking advantage and stealing from people, the elite in North Korea taking advantage, and families breaking apart. I mean, that's what happened. I mean, people weren't even able to tell each other that they were defecting. Family members couldn't tell each other that they were leaving. Why is that? Not because you don't necessarily want the person to know, but because you don't want to implicate the person in case they're interrogated, or in case you don't want them to catch any slack for you for the choices that you're making. But in terms of the cohesion, there were cases reported to me of whole families committing suicide together. You know, to me, that's a sign of cohesion. And at the same time, it's a sign of disintegration. I mean, what's interesting is that in terms of this cohesion and disintegration, right? So you have differences in how people live in Pyongyang and how people live in Chongjin, but it's not always so apparent. But then I asked North Koreans, what did you think and how did you respond when you saw that there were some people who did quite well in your area and they were doing better than you? And for example, these could be, although they weren't always, these individuals who did better could be people like the In Min Ban. This is a term which I guess could be roughly translated as like the neighborhood watch. These are people who are tasked with observing the kind of comings and goings and the political loyalty of like five other families within their building. Or even, for instance, other groups that might be slightly more privileged would be soldiers within the military, soldiers who are doing their military service. But anyway, the point is, I was trying to get a sense of how inequality is understood in North Korea, a society which claims to have no inequality, and a society that claims to have no classes. And, you know, what was really intriguing to me was that North Koreans kind of gave out these different kind of sokdan, these different kind of kind of sayings that said like, well, the secret police eats secretly and the security police eats securely and the party workers eat like they're having a party, you know. And these were very kind of poetic, rhythmic kind of jokes that they would share about witnessing the inequality. And to me, this was really intriguing because it showed like, well, it confirmed A, that North Korea does have inequality, and B, that the people are aware of it, and C, that it can't really be critiqued directly, but you need to have these alternate registers of speech to do it.
Right. And this really comes out in the next section of chapter 3, Life of Words, where actually you bring specific attention to a real strength of the book as a whole, which is this very close, nuanced care that you take to talk about the language. Lots of the interviews, for example, I should say, are quoted at length so that you get some sense of real narrative progression there. And also the specifics of pauses in speech and words and nuanced language are really brought out extremely clearly all the way through, which lends a real power to the accounts that you transmit. So perhaps we can move on to this next chapter where language is one of the key focal points. I suppose there's almost a methodological question here, because when speech is such a sensitive and important issue, and when we've already discussed the politics of naming the famine and how the government tried to frame things in certain ways. How do you go about using language in interview forms as a mode of elicitation, as a way of bringing out memories, recollections, and stories about an experience when language itself is so stigmatized and so politically significant in the context that, your interlocutors are talking about?
Well, I suppose the first just simple methodological thing to explain is that I had, you know, gone to Korea initially to learn Korean so that I could speak to North Koreans directly myself. I didn't want to have to work with translators. And I did all the interviews in Korean. And of course, I am not like the level of a native speaker of Korean, but in many ways, being a foreigner who spoke Korean, facilitated a different type of access to knowledge from North Koreans, because especially in places like South Korea and certainly Japan, we were seen as mutual. I mean, they saw me, of course, as a foreigner, but they were also foreigners in these areas, in these countries. And so there was that kind of kinship, if you will, in the sense of being a foreigner. But the other thing about language that I want to say is what's really curious about famine is that famine is very much connected to free speech and free media. So if you look at any place where there has been famine, there you are going to also find a situation, a condition where there is no free media. And that's what we see in North Korea. So to me, this was really intriguing because not only is there difficulty in getting access or altering your access to food, but there's also difficulty in accessing direct, clear articulation and direct and clear information. So you can't get complete information on the conditions throughout your country. Why are things the way they are? And so you're reliant on rumor. And of course, we know in North Korea, there is no such thing as free speech. There is no such thing as free media. Yes, media leaks in from the outside world. And yes, North Koreans are some of the most incredible wordsmiths I've ever met in my life. They're very creative and poetic with their language, but that doesn't mean there's free speech. So those facts just have to be laid out there. So it was really one of the things intellectually and sort of just as a fellow human that really interested me was, how are you talking about this thing that you're experiencing when your government is denying it? No one around you can speak so directly about it. And you don't even really have a kind of set of agreed terminology to speak about it. You know, the government was talking about it as the Konini Hengun, the government, the March of Suffering. The government was making recommendations about so-called substitute foods that people could eat. This is basically classic kind of socialist, like ersatz food. I mean, people are basically eating things that are non-foods, things that are manufactured just to fill up the stomach. And the government would say, you know, make sure you eat your substitute today, make sure you eat the substitute food. And then North Koreans would just amongst themselves pick up key terms that the government was using and then kind of, you know, alter them or make them their own and subvert the state rhetoric in these very subtle ways. This was something that really intrigued me because to me it suggested an indirect critique of the government.
Right, yeah. And I think that's a picture of North Korean society that is, well, when one thinks about it, of course, there will be humor and there will be these kind of subtle uses of language. And indeed, often we've seen in a great number of authoritarian contexts, sometimes those conditions of informational scarcity and high level of government control over discourse and what can and can't be said engender some of the most creative and most linguistically interesting strategies. And so that chapter really includes some incredibly fascinating and rich information about jokes and about conversational strategies. Mm.
But on that point, Ed, I mean, I feel like, you know, it wasn't such an obvious thing to say. I mean, now if you look at the media and the literature, you can see that people do note that, oh, you know, North Koreans are not robots. They're not brainwashed. But at the time, it was kind of an unusual thing to even be asking. And I did deliberately ask North Koreans about some jokes or humor that they remember from the famine years. Deliberately, I asked them this. And I only knew to ask this because I had read about, you know, humor being used in the concentration camps of Nazi-occupied Europe, you know, or Solzhenitsyn writing about it in Gulag Archipelago. I mean, I had known that humor was something that comes in addition to just general life, but in these dark spaces as well. I think it's not something automatically that people assume about North Korea. But if I can, I just want to say something about this. You know, the phrases and the jokes were a critique of the situation, but it's really interesting because the thing that surprised me, I think, most in doing the research was that North Koreans didn't, when they were inside North Korea, didn't necessarily see their government as primarily responsible for bringing the famine on them. There was such a lack of information, there was such a confusion of among the rumors, there was such an inability to corroborate the things that you had heard. People didn't necessarily see the government as responsible. They saw, oh, it's my fault because I can't make do with what the government is asking me, or it's the local government officials who are taking advantage, or things like this. It was never seen to be a problem of the political structure itself. There was never this understanding that politics and economics are deeply wedded together.
I mean, could you say a little bit more? What was the government sort of doing at this time? Were there new strategies deployed from either the center or from local governments with regard to managing famine? And actually, moving on to the next chapter, Life Leaves Death Behind. What kind of sort of punishments were meted out for some of the disorderliness that resulted from famine conditions and so on? Could you say something about the government's actions in this context?
So the North Korean government, by allowing the famine to take place, I mean, the North Korean government would have known that the famine was going to take place and would have known that a certain percentage of the population is going to die if we don't take particular actions. They then opened up, you might remember, in the mid-1990s to taking international aid. This was kind of a crisis response, I think, from North Korea. They did take in international aid, but every single person who I interviewed said that they didn't get access to the aid, that they saw the aid being given out. And then as soon as the monitors were gone, the aid was then taken back. So basically, it was just a pantomime of receiving the aid. Many people report that it was siphoned off to the military. So the government wasn't making any actions that would have ameliorated people's situation and made life easier for them. They did, in the end, begin to tolerate black markets, gray markets, but there were periods when North Korean soldiers were ordered, of course, shoot to kill if anyone's crossing the border, but also many of the interviewees reported, you know, seeing somebody stealing, you know, the smallest of potatoes from a field and being shot on the spot for doing that, or people receiving public execution for, you know, collecting copper wire from a factory. So people were trying to make, ordinary people were trying to make do. They were trying to be creative with their survival. But the North Korean government saw this as a threat to the state. I mean, this was disorder. This was chaos. And they responded very harshly. In terms of human rights, you know, their North Korea was violating their personal or physical integrity rights. I mean, when you are going out of your way to imprison people for stealing or to publicly execute them, that's a violation of their physical integrity. I mean, this is the basic type of human right that you're violating. The state doesn't have to do that. The state could just take no action, but they're going out of their way to violate those rights. Prior to that, they were violating people's rights in the economic, social, and political sphere by not allowing them to speak up and make complaints, by not allowing them to sell in the black markets, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, the North Korean government controlled people even migrating within the country itself. This was something which was harshly controlled. And, you know, I mean, the legacies of suffering just built upon themselves. I mean, it's really horrendous when you think about it. And I'll just add one point. You know, you could say, well, wouldn't the North Korean government have thought, hey, if we don't respond humanely to this famine situation, aren't people going to rebel? And in the United States government, and I think many other parts of the world in the mid-1990s, there was this assumption that the famine conditions in North Korea are going to lead to a social uprising. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if North Korean government was just taking a risk, if they just thought they don't care. But if they had looked at the historical record, which they may have done, you know, Great Leap Forward famine, any other famine, they would have known that famine doesn't lead to social unrest. Famine doesn't lead to revolution. And so they could have known this is not going to happen. Like, people aren't going to be able to rise up. I mean, for other reasons, obviously, as in addition to the famine, there's not going to be a revolution here from lack of food shortage.
Right, right. Well, and then, yeah, this all builds and builds and contributes to a pretty horrifying situation for such a large number of people. But as you mention in the book, and as was key, I think, to your interview experiences, not everybody left either. Most didn't leave. And so in chapter 5, entitled Breaking Points, you discuss some of the specific things that drove certain kinds of people to leave, to make the decision to try to escape North Korea. What were those, and what sort of people made it out?
Well, you know, this is a tricky thing because you're trying to understand who stays by, you know, you're dealing just with an absence, because you can't get into North Korea to speak directly to these people. I mean, some people have obviously gone into North Korea, but you're not going to be able to speak directly to famine survivors. And if you appeal to the government to go in and speak to famine survivors, you're not going to get in. So what type of people left? I mean, these individuals are self-selecting to leave. Many, you know, you can see right in the book, I mean, I think a few people left because, you know, they had seen these public executions and they realized what the person was being executed for. They deemed that in and of themselves, like within their own moral code, let's say, outside of the moral code provided by the government, they deemed that to be unfair. They didn't like what they were seeing in terms of the public executions. They felt that they were, their own lives were under threat, and they wanted to take a chance. Many people said, you know, the price was the same. If I stay, I'll die. If I leave, I might die. I might get killed, or I'll probably die. Well, so I'm going to take the risk. I'm going to take the gamble. Other people left because, you know, their children had died, and they felt that, and then that enraged them just toward, in some cases, this enraged them toward the North Korean state itself. Like, I have nothing here anymore. I'm going to leave this country. And for many of them, the listeners might know, the vast majority of North Koreans have to pass into China. So it's not as if they're saying, oh, I'm leaving North Korea and I'll go directly to South Korea. I mean, it doesn't work that way. So China is where most people are going, the vast, vast majority. You know, and so it was often seeing things that were quite horrific or realizing that they didn't have, you know, classic thing of choiceless choices, that they wanted to survive and they opted for that option. I'm sure there were other people who stayed in North Korea. I mean, many people report that the most loyal people died during the famine because they did what the government told them to do. Then there are other people who I suspect, maybe opted to stay in North Korea and continue to try to struggle on through, either because they were loyal or because, you know, they have these family ties. Like, we as anthropologists talk about this all the time. Like, I mean, the familiarity of home, that workplace, that whole education structure, the whole institution of life in North Korea, that is what you know. You don't know anything else. So why would you choose to leave? I mean, to me, this is completely rational that you would choose to stay despite things being difficult. There is always that sense in human beings, the delusion of reprieve. I think most people have this delusion of reprieve in any kind of horrendously difficult situation. So that's the type of stuff that we saw. I mean, other people, I think I can't remember at which point I put this in the book, but there's a story of a man in Pyongyang, and he'd come out of his building and he saw a woman and her child, and basically they had starved to death. But also, when he reports it to the authorities, he says that they have frozen to death, that they died of cold. Again, this goes with the language thing. People couldn't say they died of starvation. They would have to say they died from pain, or they died from being cold. But, you know, when he phoned the local authorities and told them, and then he learned, oh, well, we're picking up bodies all over the place. Like, look, you got to give us some time. We've got a lot of people to collect. I mean, just realizing that this is not a situation I want to live in anymore.
And I suppose part of the difficulty of making that decision to leave, as well as all of the things that you've just mentioned about home and about, well, the sheer complicatedness as well of getting out, is the fact that once you're out, there's no prospects at all for getting back in or really having any kind of meaningful contact with anyone who's still there, relatives or friends or anybody. And in the final chapter, The New Division, you talk about how the act of leaving reproduces the kind of dynamics of division on the peninsula as a whole, arguably a kind of defining condition of Korea, if we think about it in the latter half of the 20th century. Could you just say more about how you conceive of this sort of reproduction of the painful split that does seem such a characteristic of tragically so many Korean lives?
Yeah, I really like how you phrase that. And that last chapter called The New Division, it really is something that struck me when I was speaking with North Koreans. I mean, North Korean defectors of all ages, whether they are in South Korea or in fact in Japan, the defectors in Japan, that, you know, they are divided from their family and friends the minute they step out of the country into China. I mean, nowadays with technology, there is some changes which I can speak about with regards to this. But it's an agonizing, I really think, like, it's such an agony for Korea, for Korean people on both sides, that there is this horrendous division, and that they, when a North Korean decides to defect, they are effectively in exile. I mean, they absolutely cannot go back. And but not only are they in exile, but if they decide to speak up and become too public, then they are also hunted. This is not something new that North Korea has done. This is something North Korea did in the late 1950s to defectors in Moscow, for instance. But, you know, and just the way... Yeah, I mean, the division marks itself in so many ways. I mean, I don't talk about this in that first book, Marching Through Suffering, but in the second book, I talk about it. Like, the division can be marked, but other scholars have written and reported about this too. The division of the Koreas is marked in the very bones, the very health of the people. If you look at North Koreans who were born, the people, let's say, Koreans who were born north of the 38th parallel, say in the 1930s, if you compare their height with North Koreans who are born today, post-division, so from 1945 on, they're shorter than their counterparts. I mean, typically they would be taller. North Koreans, people from the northern part of the peninsula, were taller than people from the southern part. But this is completely reversed now in terms of tuberculosis, multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis. This is rampant in North Korea. It's almost been eradicated in South Korea and, of course, Japan. So this division kind of replicates over and over and over, like in the cells of the people. Like you can see that politics becomes, I mean, in the Foucauldian sense, biopolitical, like profoundly, this is biopolitics. I just want to say one other thing, going back to the other chapter about North Koreans leaving. I mean, perhaps listeners might not be aware, like when North Koreans leave, they are walking. Most of them walk. And so, and they're walking across a highly mountainous terrain. North Korea is very mountainous, as is South Korea, but North Korea far more so. So, I mean, to leave is also just physically onerous, and just it takes a lot of time and it's very difficult. And I mean, there are some North Koreans who have managed to steal trucks and drive across and things like this, but the vast majority are walking out. So, yeah, that's also something I just wanted to add to that chapter.
Sure, sure. Well, I think all of these markers of division, all of the ways that that is expressed and borne by the populations of the peninsula are certainly key things for us to be thinking about, even as I suppose cautiously we might say that things are at least cooling a little, or well, warming up, cooling, depending on how you think things started. But the atmosphere at least is one of greater dialogue, and who knows where things will go. But I think what you bring out in this book is incredibly important for us to understand when trying to see how things are operating on the Korean Peninsula today. So, Sandra, thank you so much for your time. Before we go, I'll ask you our sort of traditional question to end these interviews. You alluded there to your second book. Could you say some more about that, or perhaps any other things that you are currently working on and what you have in the pipeline?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me with the interview, Ed, and I hope some of what we've explored has been helpful for listeners. I just finished writing, it took me about 3 years to write a second book, and it's called Dying for Rights, Putting North Korea's Human Rights Abuses on the Record. It's coming out with Columbia University Press next year. Basically, it explores the culpability of the North Korean state for human rights violations from the formation of the country in 1948 through the Korean War up to the present. It basically also looks at human rights violations that happen in the political, social, economic spheres, but also the violations to physical or personal integrity rights. It looks at rights violations that North Korea exports overseas in terms of overseas workers, and North Korea's treatment of foreign nationals inside its country and beyond its borders. And finally, it looks at North Korean state media and North Korea at the United Nations and how it manipulates messaging on human rights and how the state denies human rights. So I hope readers might find that helpful for understanding the whole context of North Korea in terms of human rights.
Yeah, well, that definitely sounds equally important. So I'm sure that as readers look to, or listeners look to, pick up the new paperback edition of this book, they will also be eager to find out what's in the new one. Sandra, thank you so much. It was great talking to you today, and I really appreciate your coming on the show.
Thanks a million, Ed. Take care.
Listeners, thank you for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. We will speak to you next time.